Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for March the 4th, 2019. This is David Corey, along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David, and good evening, everyone. Tonight we have a very special show on a complex topic, one that affects not only those in the military and their families, but the country and the entire world. That is the topic of war and peace. First, though, I'd like to acknowledge two sponsors of our show, Joyce and Joe Civaroli, whose financial contribution helps us provide this weekly show for the benefit of veterans and their families across the country. I'll also remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, comments, and questions. So you can call in at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the number is 1-888-627-6008. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Richard. On June the 10th, 1963, in the middle of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, and only 8 months after the Cuban Missile Crisis, which brought the world to the brink of nuclear war, President John F. Kennedy delivered an historic speech on the subject of peace. That speech helped lower the risks of nuclear war with the Soviet Union and opened the way to important treaties on atomic testing and future treaties on arms controls. Unfortunately, in the decades since, the United States has been engaged in multiple wars, while the goal of promoting peace seems elusive. Since the attacks of September the 11th, 2001, the United States has been at war not only in Afghanistan and Iraq, but in other nations as well. Now, years later, the so-called global war on terror has no apparent end in sight, as special forces and drone warfare has extended throughout the Middle East, as well as many countries in Africa. Innocent civilians have died by the hundreds of thousands, and we seem to be only creating more enemies as time goes on. Meanwhile, we are on the verge of restarting the Cold War with Russia, including a new nuclear arms race, and military competition and friction between the United States and China have the potential to escalate into something worse. Decades-long problems with North Korea and Iran present the risks of war, including even nuclear war. The United States defense budget has reached record levels of over $700 billion a year, and U.S. arms sales, as well as U.S.-based private security companies, or as some would say mercenaries, spread across the globe at levels never before seen. Words of President Kennedy from 1963 are as relevant today as they were when first delivered. It is our purpose tonight in this show to also provide an overview of an ongoing project which Richard Hurley and I have been involved in to promote the concept of peace building, turning away from the mindset that violence and warfare are inevitable and unavoidable. So join us with open minds and open hearts in this endeavor. It is time for a new way of thinking, one that does not glorify war, and one that recognizes that international conflict can and must be resolved without violence. Peace is possible, practical, and necessary. So without further ado, I present President Kennedy and his commencement address to the faculty and graduating class of American University on June the 10th, 1963.
President Anderson, members of the faculty, Board of Trustees, distinguished guests, my old colleague, Senator Bob Byrd, who has earned his degree through many years of attending Knight Law School, while I am earning mine in the next 30 minutes, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pride that I participate in this ceremony of the American University, sponsored by the Methodist Church, founded by Bishop John Fletcher Hurst, and first opened by President Woodrow Wilson in 1914. This is a young and growing university, but it has already fulfilled Bishop Hurst's enlightened hope for the study of history and public affairs in a city devoted to the making of history and to the conduct of the public's business. By sponsoring this institution of higher learning for all who wish to learn, whatever their color or their creed, the Methodists of this area and the nation deserve the nation's thanks. And I commend all those who are today graduating. Professor Woodrow Wilson once said that every man sent out from a university should be a man of his nation as well as a man of his time. And I'm confident that the men and women who carry the honor of graduating from this institution will continue to give from their lives, from their talents, a high measure of public service and public support. There are few earthly things more beautiful than a university, wrote John Masefield in his tribute to English universities, and his words are equally true today. He did not refer to towers or to campuses. He admired the splendid beauty of a university because it was, he said, a place where those who hate ignorance may strive to know, where those who perceive truth may strive to make others see. I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived, and that is the most important topic on earth, peace. What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time. I speak of peace because of the new face of war. Total war makes no sense in an age where great powers can maintain large and relatively invulnerable nuclear forces and refuse to surrender without resort to those forces. It makes no sense in an age where a single nuclear weapon contains almost 10 times the explosive force delivered by all the Allied air forces in the Second World War. It makes no sense in an age when the deadly poisons produced by a nuclear exchange would be carried by wind and water and soil and seed to the far corners of the globe and to generations yet unborn. Today, the expenditure of billions of dollars every year on weapons acquired for the purpose of making sure we never need them is essential to the keeping of peace. But surely the acquisition of such idle stockpiles, which can only destroy and never create, is not the only, much less the most efficient, means of assuring peace. I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task. Some say that it is useless to speak of peace or world law or world disarmament, and that it will be useless until the leaders of the Soviet Union adopt a more enlightened attitude. I hope they do. I believe we can help them do it. But I also believe that we must re-examine our own attitudes as individuals and as a nation, for our attitude is as essential as theirs. And every graduate of this school
every thoughtful citizen who despairs of war and wishes to bring peace should begin by looking inward, by examining his own attitude towards the possibilities of peace, towards the Soviet Union, towards the course of the Cold War, and towards freedom and peace here at home. First, examine our attitude towards peace itself. Too many of us think it is impossible. Too many think it is unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control. We need not accept that view. Our problems are man-made. Therefore, they can be solved by man, and man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again. I am not referring to the absolute, infinite concept of universal peace and goodwill, of which some fantasies and fanatics dream. I do not deny the value of hopes and dreams, but we merely invite discouragement and incredulity by making that our only and immediate goal. Let us focus instead on a more practical, more attainable peace, based not on a sudden revolution in human nature, but on a gradual evolution in human institutions, on a series of concrete actions and effective agreements which are in the interests of all concerned. There is no single simple key to this peace, no grand or magic formula to be adopted by one or two powers. Genuine peace must be the product of many nations, the sum of many acts. It must be dynamic, not static, changing to meet the challenge of each new generation. For peace is a process, a way of solving problems. With such a peace, there will still be quarrels and conflicting interests, as there are within families and nations. World peace, like community peace, does not require that each man love his neighbor. It requires only that they live together in mutual tolerance, submitting their disputes to a just and peaceful settlement. And history teaches us that enmities between nations, as between individuals, do not last forever. However fixed our likes and dislikes may seem, the tide of time and events will often bring surprising changes in the relations between nations and neighbors. So let us persevere. Peace need not be impractical, and war need not be inevitable. By defining our goal more clearly, by making it seem more manageable and less remote, we can help all people to see it, to draw hope from it, and to move irresistibly towards it. And second, let us re-examine our attitude towards the Soviet Union. It is discouraging to think that their leaders may actually believe what their propagandists write. It is discouraging to read a recent authoritative Soviet text on military strategy and find on page after page wholly baseless and incredible claims, such as the allegation that American imperialist circles are preparing to unleash different types of war, that there is a very real threat of a preventative war being unleashed by American imperialists against the Soviet Union, and that the political aims, and I quote, of the American imperialists are to enslave economically and politically the European and other capitalist countries and to achieve world domination by means of aggressive war, unquote. Truly, as it was written long ago, the wicked flee when no man pursueth. Yet it is sad to read these Soviet statements to realize the extent of the gulf between us. But it is also a warning to the American people not to fall into the same trap as the Soviets, not to see only a distorted and desperate view of the other side, not to see conflict as inevitable, accommodation as impossible, and communication as nothing more than an exchange of threats. No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. Among the many traits the peoples of our two countries have in common, none is stronger than our mutual abhorrence of war. Almost unique, among the major world powers, we have never been at war with each other. And no nation in the history of battle ever suffered more than the Soviet Union in the Second World War. At least 20 million lost their lives. Countless millions of homes and families were burned or sacked. A third of the nation's territory, including two-thirds of its industrial base, was turned into a wasteland, a loss equivalent to the destruction of this country east of Chicago. Today, should total war ever break out again, no matter how, our two countries will be the primary target. It is an ironic but accurate fact that the two strongest powers are the two in the most danger of devastation. All we have built, all we have worked for, would be destroyed in the first 24 hours. And even in the Cold War, which brings burdens and dangers to so many countries, including this nation's closest allies, our two countries bear the heaviest burdens. For we are both devoting massive sums of money to weapons that could be better devoted to combat ignorance, poverty, and disease. We are both caught up in a vicious and dangerous cycle, with suspicion on one side breeding suspicion on the other, and new weapons begetting counterweapons. In short, both the United States and its allies, and the Soviet Union and its allies, have a mutually deep interest in a just and genuine peace and in halting the arms race. Agreements to this end are in the interests of the Soviet Union as well as ours. And even the most hostile nations can be relied upon to accept and keep those treaty obligations, and only those treaty obligations, which are in their own interest. So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal. Third, let us re-examine our attitude towards the Cold War, remembering we're not engaged in a debate, seeking to pile up debating points. We are not here distributing blame or pointing the finger of judgment. We must deal with the world as it is, and not as it might have been, had the history of the last 18 years been different. We must therefore persevere in the search for peace, in the hope that constructive changes within the communist bloc might bring within reach solutions which now seem beyond us. We must conduct our affairs in such a way that it becomes in the communist interests to agree on a genuine peace, and above all, while defending our own vital interests, nuclear powers must avert those confrontations which bring an adversary to a choice of either a humiliating retreat or a nuclear war. To adopt that kind of course in the nuclear age would be evidence only of the bankruptcy of our policy or of a collective death wish for the world. To secure these ends, America's weapons are non-provocative, carefully controlled, designed to deter and capable of selective use. Our military forces are committed to peace and disciplined in self-restraint. Our diplomats are instructed to avoid unnecessary irritants and purely rhetorical hostility, for we can seek a relaxation of tensions without relaxing our guard. And for our part, we do not need to use threats to prove we are resolute. We do not need to jam foreign broadcasts out of fear our faith will be eroded. We are unwilling to impose our system on any unwilling people, but we are willing and able to engage in peaceful competition with any people on earth. Meanwhile, we seek to strengthen the United Nations to help solve its financial problems, to make it a more effective instrument for peace, to develop it into a genuine world security system, a system capable of resolving disputes on the basis of law, of ensuring the security of the large and the small, and of creating conditions under which arms can finally be abolished. At the same time, we seek to keep peace inside the non-communist world, where many nations, all of them our friends, are divided over issues which weaken Western unity, which invite communist intervention, or which threaten to erupt into war. Our efforts in West New Guinea, in the Congo, in the Middle East, and the Indian subcontinent have been persistent and patient, despite criticism from both sides. We have also tried to set an example for others by seeking to adjust small but significant differences with our own closest neighbors in Mexico and Canada. Speaking of other nations, I wish to make one point clear. We are bound to many nations by alliances. These alliances exist because our concern and theirs substantially overlap. Our commitment to defend Western Europe and West Berlin, for example, stands undiminished because of the identity of our vital interests. The United States will make no deal with the Soviet Union at the expense of other nations and other peoples, not merely because they are our partners, but also because their interests and ours converge. Our interests converge, however, not only in defending the frontiers of freedom, but in pursuing the paths of peace. It is our hope and the purpose of Allied policy to convince the Soviet Union that she, too, should let each nation choose its own future, so long as that choice does not interfere with the choices of others. The communist drive to impose their political and economic system on others is the primary cause of world tension today. For there can be no doubt that if all nations could refrain from interfering in the self-determination of others, the peace would be much more assured. This will require a new effort to achieve world law, a new context for world discussions. It will require increased understanding between the Soviets and ourselves. An increased understanding will require increased contact and communication. One step in this direction is the proposed arrangement for a direct line between Moscow and Washington to avoid on each side the dangerous delays, misunderstandings, and misreadings of others' actions which might occur at a time of crisis. We have also been talking in Geneva about our first step measures of arms controls designed to limit the intensity of the arms race and reduce the risk of accidental war. Our primary long-range interest in Geneva, however, is general and complete disarmament, designed to take place by stages, permitting parallel political developments to build the new institutions of peace which would take the place of arms. The pursuit of disarmament has been an effort of this government since the 1920s. It has been urgently sought by the past three administrations. And however dim the prospects are today, we intend to continue this effort, to continue it in order that all countries, including our own, can better grasp what the problems and the possibilities of disarmament are. the only major area of these negotiations where the end is in sight, yet where a fresh start is badly needed, is in a treaty to outlaw nuclear tests. The conclusion of such a treaty, so near and yet so far, would check the spiraling arms race in one of its most dangerous areas. It would place the nuclear powers in a position to deal more effectively with one of the greatest hazards which man faces in 1963, the further spread of nuclear arms. It would increase our security. It would decrease the prospects of war. Surely this goal is sufficiently important to require our steady pursuit, yielding neither to the temptation to give up the whole effort, nor the temptation to give up our insistence on vital and responsible safeguards. I'm taking this opportunity, therefore, to announce two important decisions in this regard. First, Chairman Khrushchev, Prime Minister McMillan, and I have agreed that high-level discussions will shortly begin in Moscow, looking towards early agreement on a comprehensive test ban treaty. Our hope must be tempered. Our hopes must be tempered with the caution of history, but with our hopes go the hopes of all mankind. Second, to make clear our good faith and solemn convictions on this matter, I now declare that the United States does not propose to conduct nuclear tests in the atmosphere so long as other states do not do so. We will not be the first to resume. Such a declaration is no substitute for a formal binding treaty, but I hope it will help us achieve one. Nor would such a treaty be a substitute for disarmament, but I hope it will help us achieve it. Finally, my fellow Americans, let us examine our attitude towards peace and freedom here at home. The quality and spirit of our own society must justify and support our efforts abroad. We must show it in the dedication of our own lives, as many of you who are graduating today will have an opportunity to do by serving without pay in the Peace Corps abroad or in the proposed National Service Corps here at home. But wherever we are, we must all, in our daily lives, live up to the age-old faith that peace and freedom walk together. In too many of our cities today, the peace is not secure because freedom is incomplete. It is the responsibility of the executive branch at all levels of government, local, state, and national, to provide and protect that freedom for all of our citizens by all means within our authority. It is the responsibility of the legislative branch at all levels, wherever the authority is not now adequate, to make it adequate. And it is the responsibility of all citizens in all sections of this country to respect the rights of others and respect the law of the land. All this is not unrelated to world peace. When a man's way please the Lord, the scriptures tell us, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. And is not peace, in the last analysis, basically a matter of human rights, the right to live out our lives without fear of devastation, the right to breathe air as nature provided it, the right of future generations to a healthy existence? While we proceed to safeguard our national interests, let us also safeguard human interests. And the elimination of war and arms is clearly in the interests of both. No treaty, however much it may be to the advantage of all, however tightly it may be worded, can provide absolute security against the risks of deception and evasion. But it can, if it is sufficiently effective in its enforcement, and it is sufficiently in the interest of its signers, offer far more security and far fewer risks than an unabated, uncontrolled, unpredictable arms race. The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
Well, what a remarkable speech, one that still has lessons applicable today. What do you think, Rick?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of interesting that it was given so long ago. Hopefully Donald Trump's listening up there in D.C. A lot of good words in there. But back to you, David.
Well, you know, we've been at war now. The United States has been at war now for about 17 and a half years. As we know, in late 2001, the United States invaded Afghanistan because that's where Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, they were hiding at the time. Then in March of 2003, 16 years ago, this month, the United States also invaded Iraq because Iraq supposedly had weapons of mass destruction and supported terrorism, but it turns out, as we now know, that it had no weapons of mass destruction and there was no link between Iraq and the 9/11 attacks. Meanwhile, since 9/11, what have been the costs of those wars? What have we learned as a nation? So those are questions which need to be discussed and which we intend to discuss tonight. We'd like to highlight in our project, and our project's website is stopwar.today, we'd like to highlight three resources to help listeners analyze these questions. First, Brown University's Costs of War Project, and that project's website is easy to find. It's at costsofwar.org. And then second, the United States Institute of Peace. Its website is usip.org. And I'd venture to say that most Americans have never heard of the United States Institute of Peace. It was created by Congress, by an act of Congress in 1984. And then third, we'd like to emphasize an excellent book called A Mighty Case Against War by author Kathy Beckwith. And I'm offering free copies to anyone that would like a copy of the book. Just send me an email. My email address is lawcorey1@verizon.net. That's LAWCORY, the number one, at verizon.net. And you can also find my contact information, including my email address, on our show's website, bbsradio.com/theveteransnewshour. So our project is to highlight and help publicize those three resources. Brown University Cost of War Project includes the work and research of about three dozen scholars. And one of the project's report states, and I quote, "More than 2.7 million U.S. service members have been to the war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001, and over half of them have deployed more than once. Many times that number of Americans have borne the costs of war as spouses, parents, children, and friends who cope with their loved ones' absence, mourn their deaths, or greet the changed person who often returns from war. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers and civilian contractors have been wounded and are living with disabilities and war-related illnesses. So far, about 1 million U.S. veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars have filed disability claims with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And based on the experience of the Vietnam War generation, everyone expects that number to continue to grow in future years and decades. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been more difficult for military families than of past wars, with more frequent deployments and shorter recovery times at home before they deploy again. In comparison to the American civilian population, Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans are facing elevated rates of suicide and mental illness, drug and alcohol dependence, car crashes, and homelessness. They and their families also experience higher rates of divorce as well. When service members return home injured, it is often their families who provide care or help provide care, even when veterans are housed in military hospitals. The offloading of care for the war wounded onto families and community organizations should count and be considered by Americans when they're trying to understand what are the true costs and the full costs of war. Now, despite the erroneous belief that modern war, the way modern war is conducted, that it spares human life, the reality is that the vast majority of people killed in these wars are Afghan, Pakistani, and Iraq civilians. Over 200,000 civilians have been killed in the fightings in those wars. People living in the war zones have been killed in their homes and marketplaces, on the roadways. They've been killed by bombs, bullets, fire, improvised explosive devices, and drones. They die at checkpoints, as they are often run off the road by military vehicles when they step on a mine or a cluster bomb, as they collect wood or tend to their fields, or when they are kidnapped and executed for purposes of revenge or intimidation. They are killed by the United States, by its allies, and by insurgents and sectarians in the civil wars that were spawned by the invasions. To continue to quote from the Cost of War Project report, it's important to realize that death can happen weeks, months, even years after a battle. Many times more Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistanis have died as a result of a battered and destroyed infrastructure and poor health conditions arising from the wars than directly from its violence. War refugees often lose access to a stable food supply or to their jobs, resulting in increased malnutrition and vulnerability to disease. So it's clear wars take a long-term toll on civilians and their livelihoods, and that includes the effects of war, death, and injuries on survivors and their families who are left to cope with those losses. Millions of people living in the war zones have been displaced by war. To date, over 10 million Afghans, Pakistanis, and Iraqis are living as war refugees in other countries or are displaced from their homes in their own country. The insecurity that they face extends far beyond the guns and the blasts of war. It includes a lack of secure access to food, health care, housing, employment, and clean water and sanitation, as well as to the loss of community itself. For war refugees, these problems are made worse in the face of exile from their countries. As I said, over 10 million people have been displaced and are living in grossly inadequate conditions. Refugees are also facing difficulties in renewing visas, the denial of civil rights and services, the fear of deportation, and anxiety about the future. Many displaced persons, usually poor migrants who lack the finances necessary to travel abroad, have had to relocate within their own countries. For example, in Baghdad, internally displaced persons often squat in bombed-out buildings with no water, electricity, sewage, or garbage disposal. Precarious living conditions are further heightened by unemployment. Those who have managed to escape the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have fled to nearby countries including Pakistan, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, Turkey, and Iran. The refugee influx into those countries have strained their resources and the livelihood of their own urban working classes. And given the general and continued reluctance of Western nations to resettle Afghan and Iraqi war refugees, the limited international assistance received by host states, and the uncertainty as to a time of return, the refugee situation continues to worsen. So that's just a part of sort of an analysis of the effects of these wars, which I say have been going on now, 2001 in Afghanistan and since 2003 in Iraq. Richard, over to you.
Yep, and the cost of war project also has reported, and I quote, as far as economic costs, the United States federal government has spent or obligated $4.8 trillion in the wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. This figure includes direct congressional war appropriations, war-related increases to the Pentagon-based budget, veterans care and disability, increases in the Homeland Security budget, interest payments on direct war, borrowing, foreign assistance spending, and estimated future obligations for veterans care. The total omits many other expenses such as macroeconomics cost to the U.S. economy, the opportunity cost of not investing war dollars in the alternative sectors, future interest on war borrowing, and local government and private war costs. The current wars have been paid for almost entirely by borrowing. This borrowing has raised the U.S. budget deficit, increased the national debt, and had other macroeconomic effects such as raising consumer interest rates. Unless the U.S. immediately repays the money borrowed for war, there will also be future interest payments. We estimate that interest payments could total over $7.9 trillion by 2053. Spending on the wars has involved opportunity costs for the U.S. economy. Although military spending does produce jobs, spending in other areas such as health care could produce more jobs. Additionally, while investment in military infrastructure grew, investment in other non-military public infrastructure such as roads and schools did not grow at the same rate. Finally, federal war costs exclude billions of dollars of state, municipal, and private war costs across the country. Dollars spent on services for returned veterans and their families in addition to local homeland security efforts. The bottom line, folks, is you can't even begin to contemplate the real costs of war. And all you got to do is look around and think outside the box about these expenditures and the consequences of all these expenditures and how it flows down to you, the average taxpayer, not only in your pocket, but in the health for veterans' families. I mean, it's mind-boggling. And, you know, we need to get something. The communication, the discussion has to get started sooner or later. And hopefully with the documentary that we're producing, that will aid in such an effect to get the conversation going. We're not naive to think that you're going to totally do away with the military machine and the necessity of having a military to support your government and your nation. But for God's sake, the cost of such of having such a military machine does not have to be what we currently are and continuing to be. So anyway, back to you, David.
Well said, Richard. I'd like to add that according to the Cost of War Project, and they did address a question that many people have, which is, well, what was the alternative after 9/11? The Cost of War Project scholars taken the position that the United States could have pursued several non-military alternatives to hold accountable those responsible for perpetrating 9/11 attacks, just as the United States and other Western nations have done historically in responding to terrorism for decades prior to 9/11. In other words, you don't need to send out the military in its full force, did not need to invade Iraq at all, and then spreading the war into this never-ending, self-perpetuating global war on terror, which is ongoing, not necessary. Terrorism is nothing new, and the U.S.'s massive military response has been extremely costly, as Richard summarized, and it's been counterproductive because it's starting and it's perpetuating a cycle, and it's expanding to any country in which even a few terrorists might live, even when they are not a direct threat to the United States. These alternatives would have been far less costly in human lives and other costs. For example, the U.S. invasion of Iraq created the conditions where militant groups such as the Islamic State, have been able to arise. The formation of jihadi groups now spreading throughout the region counts among the many human costs of that war, which we started. It's interesting how in President Kennedy's speech in June of 1963, if you remember what he said, the United States will never start a war. Well, how surprised he might be to know that 40 years later, we did start a war, a preemptive war, by invading Iraq. Now, beyond the issues of Iraq and Afghanistan, there is the much larger issue of the global American military presence and its costs and effects. The U.S. Department of Defense budget is now over $700 billion, that's billion with a B, per year, while by comparison, the United States Institute of Peace, established in 1984 by Congress, receives only about $38 million a year from Congress to fulfill its mission of helping to prevent war by resolving international conflict in peaceful ways. Now, I've just given two numbers here. The defense budget of $700 billion and the U.S. Institute of Peace of $38 million. What do those numbers mean? I mean, billion, million, we lose track. Well, let's, just for comparison, let's knock off some of those zeros and you'll see what the difference is. It's like comparing $700,000 to $38. Which do you think will have a bigger effect? Which do you think kind of illustrates or demonstrates the relative priorities of the country? And on the one hand, as President Kennedy said, you know, he was not defining peace as a Pax Americana, where you had peace that was enforced by American weapons of war. He wasn't defining it that way, and yet that's exactly what we have now. How many Americans have ever even heard of the United States Institute of Peace? Well, we've discovered that in our own informal polling, that very few actually have, and that includes people who are very interested in these issues, well-educated people. There have been Americans throughout the nation's history, even from the earliest days and throughout the 1800s up to today, calling for a cabinet-level department whose mission is to promote peace. Now, you might say, well, don't we have a State Department? Yes, its mission is quite different from that focus. The closest thing the Congress has created, though, is, as I mentioned, the United States Institute of Peace, a nonpartisan institute created and funded by Congress. Its modern building in Washington, D.C., just north of the Lincoln Memorial, has been its home since 2011, just 8 years. Before that, it would use rental space and offices in Washington. But it functions on a relatively small budget, even today, and has only about 300 employees. It has had its share of critics from both the political right and left, but the bottom line is its small size and limited impact mirrors the misplaced priorities of the nation in promoting war rather than peace building. So it's our view it's time to change from mindset of militarism to peace building. When your only tool is a hammer, every problem starts to look like a nail. And U.S. leaders act all too often like the only solution to international conflict is the military and violence. So it's time to change that thinking. Peace is possible. It may not be easy or simple, and we are certainly not naive, but it is possible. A nation that can put humans on the moon 50 years ago and which can create mind-boggling technology surely has the intelligence to find ways to promote peace and solve international conflict without going to war. We will be working to publicize, as I said, the work of the Cost of War Project, as well as many other groups and individuals, to create an effective call-to-action multimedia project, which will include an ongoing series of documentary films on the cost of war, militarism, and peace building. That includes the U.S. Institute of Peace. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, we recommend an outstanding book called A Mighty Case Against War by Kathy Beckwith. It provides an insightful analysis of America's past wars and ways they could have been prevented. And it provides the path to a new way of thinking and how to promote peace and stop glorifying war. We strive to spark a change in thinking about these issues, promoting peace building rather than militarism. We believe that we are basically picking up the torch from President Kennedy in his speech in 1963 and moving it forward to this current generation. So the time is now. We hope you will support our cause. Check out our website, which is stopwar.today. And, of course, if you can help, contact us. Our contact information is on that website. Again, the website is stopwar.today. Over to you, Richard.
Well, very good, David. Thank you for all that. Before we close tonight, I once again want to remind our listeners about the the Coaching in the Care program run by the VA. This program helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching in the Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call at 1-888-823-7458. It's hours of operation on Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the VA's Coaching in the Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has a Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Thank you, Richard. And I'd like to just remind our listeners again that if you wish to contact me to get a copy of the book, A Mighty Case Against War, my email address is lawcorey1@verizon.net. That's LAWCORY, the number 1@verizon.net. I'll be happy to send you your own free copy of the book, A Mighty Case Against War. Well, it's about time for us to go. For this evening, we'd like to thank all of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. We'd like to, as we do every week, thank our sponsors, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli and Corey and Hurley Law Group. We'd also like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom, for the great job he does for us every week. And we hope you found tonight's show inspiring as well as informative. President Kennedy's 1963 speech on peace was an historic one, and its message is valid today. And I think many people would agree that President Kennedy's wisdom and eloquence on that subject is something that seems to be sorely lacking in today's political arena. So again, we hope you have enjoyed tonight's show. If you have any interest in more information on our project, go to our website, stopwar.today. Contact Richard Hurley or myself and get involved. We hope you'll tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio. Until then, we hope you have a great week. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.